You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 122. I hope you've lived a life you're proud of. If you find that you've not, I hope you have the strength to start all over again. Eric Roth.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, you are in for a major treat. Today on the show, we have legendary screenwriter and producer Eric Roth. Now, if you haven't heard of Eric Roth, you're probably new to screenwriting, and I'm going to teach you a little bit about who this man is. He won the Oscar for Forrest Gump, writing Forrest Gump, and he's written a few other films you might have heard of, like The Horse Whisperer for Robert Redford, The Insider and Ali for Michael Mann, Munich for Steven Spielberg, The Good Shepherd with Robert De Niro, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button for David Fincher, and most recently, the remake of A Star is Born for Bradley Cooper, and the remake of the almost impossible to adapt book, Dune, as well as working with Martin Scorsese on his latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. He's also the producer, the Oscar-nominated producer of Mank, and he was also the co-creator, along with David Fincher, of House of Cards for Netflix, which changed the entire industry when it came out all those years ago. And that is just some of the stuff that our guest today has done. I've been a huge fan of Eric's for a long time. His films that he's written has really impacted me as a filmmaker and as just a moviegoer. And it was such a thrill to talk to him about what it was like to, you know, what the story was behind Forrest Gump, what it was like working with legendary filmmakers like Spielberg and Scorsese and all these other filmmakers. And I found out that he even worked with the legendary Akira Kurosawa on a film right before he passed. It was a mind-blowing conversation, and we get deep into the weeds on his writing process, how he approaches story, how he approaches adaptation, how the business is, and just some hilarious and amazing behind-the-scenes stories of his journeys through Hollyweird. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Eric Roth. I'd like to welcome to the show Eric Roth. How are you doing, Eric?
Good. I'm doing good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. As I was saying earlier, before we got on, I am a huge fan of your work over the years. And during my formative years in the video store, some of your early works, I watched like Suspect and Wolf and a couple of those things. And I just had Whitley on on another show that I another podcast.
Oh, yeah, a wonderful writer. Yeah.
Oh my God, wonderful human
yeah,
being.
Yeah, that was a special job for me. I mean, I came on to rewrite it, and Michael Wadley directed it. Mm-hmm. And a quick story, and stop me when I tell too many stories, but just relate to my age, I think, more than anything. Michael, I remember watching a movie called The Man Who Skied Down Everest, and it was about a Japanese guy who went to climb Mount Everest and then skied down. It wasn't really so much skiing down. After a bit, he opened a parachute and he parachuted down. But I said, wait a minute, somebody had to be the cinematographer on this. Who filmed this? Michael Wadley. And Michael went on to do Woodstock. And and then I met Michael on this, which Alan King was the producer. It was really an interesting movie. The whole movie was kind of interesting. Albert Finney and everything.
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, it was remarkable.
Good movie.
Yeah, going back through some of the older films that you at the beginning of your career, I started seeing the cast. I'm like, oh my God, is that James Earl Jones? Is that dancing? Is like it's like they're young, they're kids. It was amazing to watch.
Exactly. Amazing. Yeah.
So how did you get into the business?
Well, I think a few routes. One, I went to. Let me see which way I could tell this tale. I went to Columbia University as in graduate school as an English major. Mm-hmm. And I started to find myself gravitating toward kind of making short films. And so I switched over to the film department. And I still took a lot of English classes because writing was what I wanted to always do. I got to be crew on a bunch of very independent movies, like literally with like Bob Downey Sr.
Wow.
Movie called Babu 16. They were very busy. A lot of movies being made from a place called the Millennium Film Workshop, a guy named Ed Emshweiler, and a lot of experimental filmmakers, real New York guys, you know, and everybody sort of switched off crews and things on those. And I was busy. I was making some shorts and I thought I wanted to be a director, and I actually had an opportunity to do kind of compete for something at a thing that was going on at USC with a little short I made, and it got me a little bit of a cachet in that sense. But the thing that was a big difference in my life was that I was at UCLA, and I entered the Samuel Goldwyn Writing Award, and I had written a script that I actually tied with Colin Higgins, mm-hmm. who wrote Harold and Maude and then went on to write. That was his script. Mm-hmm. And he went on to write 9 to 5. And I think he died of AIDS, I'm afraid to say. But he was a wonderful writer. And it literally was the day after my first child was born. I was quite young. And the $500 paid for the baby. So I won for the Goldwyn Award. But more importantly, it got me an agent.
Wow.
So it got me an agent, and I must say that was 1970.
Wow. And
basically, I've been working ever since, you know.
And the business has changed a bit over the years.
Yeah. I mean, some of it I've been either, I can't say for good or for ill, but like House of Cards was mine with David Fincher.
Right.
And that certainly changed the business, you know.
Right. And yeah, we're going to get into House of Cards in a bit.
But for a while I was kind of treading water. I got a couple little movies made and did some rewrites. I mean, I went to I always tell this story, which is a lovely story, that I was friendly with Stuart Rosenberg, who directed A Cool Hand Luke, and it worked together on later on we worked on The Onion Field, but. Mm-hmm. Stuart liked my work as a young writer, and he brought me on to rewrite The Drowning Pool, which was a Paul Newman movie. And I was literally, I think, 19 or 20, maybe 20 years old. And I had on,
That's so amazing.
I've been out this for a good, you know, 50 odd years.
So let me ask you a question. When you're 19 working on a Paul Newman film, because I mean, at that time, Paul Newman was Paul Newman.
God, yeah.
He was falling. So
when he called my house, people gave, quit fucking around, Alan, you know, like some friend. And right. But I went down there and I bought a new, I always tell the story the same way. So I've told this before, but I bought a new pair of corduroys and I had a new briefcase and I walked on the set and Newman said, and there was him, Joanna Woodward, Tony Franciosa, a couple other people that were, I mean, known actors. And he said, our savior's here. And I said, oh, really? I don't know about that. But it was a wonderful experience. I got to know Paul quite well. We remained friends for the rest of his life in a certain way. And Stewart had a kind of up and down kind of career, but was a nice man. And when he hit, he was really a good director. You know.
So would you consider that your first big break?
I think winning that award and getting me the agent was a huge thing. Then I was on a tiny little movie that was only released in America for like 2 weeks. But it was an original piece that I wrote with an oddball, interesting man who was a director for Billy Graham, the religious leader.
Sure.
He made his religious films and he wanted to do a lay film set in Israel. And I wrote a little love story for him. And we went to Israel. That was shot in 1970, I guess. Yeah, or 69. And that was one. And the other break I had was after the Goldwyn War, I'd written a script called at that time 50-50, which was a oddball kind of in keeping with the times. They made a lot of anarchistic kind of movies or movies that were, you know, they were in keeping with, I don't, it's not anywhere as good as Mean Streets or something or Easy Rider, you know, these movies that were like abstract, I guess, better word. And I wrote a movie called 50-50. That Bob Mulligan signed on to do. And Bob Mulligan was famous for Kill a Mockingbird and Fear Strikes Out. And he made some wonderful movies. He was a real kind of old timey director. And George C. Scott was going to do it. And the premise was about a guy who is in a dangerous profession and is turning 50. So I'm looking at that point, at whatever age I was, I thought 50 was so old, it's beyond comprehension. You know, and he's petrified, and it was an odd little movie. And Scott decided eventually not to do it. The star of it was a guy named Jason Miller, who was in The Exorcist as the young priest, and also happened to win the Pulitzer Prize for a play he wrote called that Championship Season. He also was married to Jackie Gleason's daughter. He was an interesting man. He had some drug issues. He was a father to, I'm trying to think of the actor's name now, who doesn't have the same name as him, but he was married to the son was married to, I'm trying to think, anyway, that's an old man's memory. he's a pretty well-known actor, and the father died young from some drug problems, I think. But he's an interesting, wonderful actor, kind of looked like Garfield, I guess, you know, a little bit. And the movie was briefly, Tarantino loves the movie. He thought it was one of the most interesting noir movies.
Interesting.
And it opened at Cannes, and it, you know, lasted a very small time in America. But that one, I think, got me a little more on the map in that sense.
You know? And then you were off and running.
I was a good bargain for people for the price that I was charging, and you know, I had things that didn't get made and things that were disappointing. You know, one of the decisions I made that was not a good decision, I went back and did work on it as rewriting, but I was asked to do The Onion Field. I mean, I'm sorry, I was asked to do Cuckoo's Nest, and my agent, and I was also at the same time asked to do The Onion Field, which was a huge book at the time. And my agent said to me, they'll never make the Cuckoo's Nest movie. And I said, oh, really? Okay. And so I decided, I chose the other one. I was friendly with Michael Douglas, and I actually came back and did some work on it. But it's one of the great movies ever made. I'd say that probably, even though the guy who wrote it, I think, is probably one of the greatest screenwriters whoever is Bo Goldman. Won an Oscar for it. And he also won an Oscar for Howard and Melvin. But He was a wonderful man. He and I are close friends. From, we both like the racetrack, so we used to go to the racetrack. But anyway, that was a movie I wish I had started from scratch on. You know?
Now you obviously had a successful career as a writer, and as writers listening know, writing is not easy. It is it's a tough thing to have to come up every day and go in. What is your writing routine? What has kept you going for all these years at such a high level?
Well, I mean, the high level, I guess you have to thank God for or something. You know, I don't know. Whatever alchemy makes up what makes you maybe good, and not, believe me, not so good in many places too. Mm-hmm. I've had a number of failures where I thought they were good, and most I think I could blame me in most respects. One, I think I blame a director on, but I always tried to pick things that would have some lasting quality. I mean, I may have been wrong, you know, mm-hmm. but I thought these things that will kind of attribute to me well when I'm getting to the end of things, you know, when you look at the credits I have. So I've been lucky that way. I've worked with everybody from Kurosawa through Marty through Spielberg, you know, so I've been lucky with incredibly talented filmmakers.
What did you work on with Kurosawa?
I did a little movie called Rhapsody in August that I wrote.
I remember the movie.
He wanted to, and I think it's one of my bigger claims to fame, to be quite honest with you, not because it's, there's a part in it for Richard Gere, who I was friendly with, and Kurosawa wanted me. It's a guy who's supposed to be an American who's marrying the main character's Japanese man's granddaughter, and she lives in Hawaii, and Richard, he wanted me to write his part, which would be an American, and he felt uncomfortable getting that written through translations. And so I wrote all the scenes between the daughter and, the son. And
I have to ask you, what is it like working with Kurosawa?
It was like, what fascinating mostly was, we had many conversations. He spoke, I don't think he spoke much English, and so translated. Mm-hmm. And then when he sent me the script, I just was so taken with it. It was written like a haiku. It was just, he'd write, the anthill. I mean, you just do two or three words, and it gave you the sense of what he wanted. And then you had me when I wrote my prose, which is very sort of Jewish intellectual, psychoanalytic garbage, maybe. But, it just was so different, But it was like a wonderful, it was like we never met, They didn't have Zoom or anything then, Right. So we just talked on the phone, and he invited me over, and there was some reason I couldn't. I think I just had a baby or something. And right. So I couldn't go. And, but it's a great honor to have even been in the same breath with him. And he gave me a lovely thank you on the movie and all that.
That's remarkable. Now, yeah. So as a writer, what is your daily writing routine?
I sort of look at writing as a job in a good way. I'm always thrilled to be able to sit down if I can create. And I look at it as a great adventure, a journey, all those things, all those kind of cliche things, but it's always true. And I get to be alone and, sort of dream and try to make those dreams come true. I do it like, I'd read once, and I don't know if I, this is what I didn't copy this, but I read this about John Cheever. And I've told this story many times. He would get up at, like, let's say 8 o'clock and take a commuter train in from New York from Long Island. And he would go to a basement, little tiny basement room that he had that he rented as his office, in quotes, with the boiler and everything. And he'd take off his pants and he'd take off his dress shirt and he'd sit in his underwear and work. Okay, so he worked till 12 o'clock. This is a story, whether true, but I like it's apocryphal.
The visuals are fantastic.
Yeah. He'd get at 12 o'clock, he'd put his pants back on, his shirt, tie his tie, put his jacket on, go out and have a one martini lunch. He'd come back at 1. He'd work till 5 with his clothes off again, put his stuff back on, neatly folded, put it back on, go and take the commuter train home. And that was his, as if he went to work. He came in for a job, And that's how he looked at it. I think you'll find most writers, not all, but most writers have some schedule, that whatever it is, could be goofy. They might write in the middle of the night. They can write things in a month. They can write things in a year. But there is some kind of, so I'm very scheduled. I start about 8 o'clock and I'm done by noon or one, and I dick around in the afternoon, and I go back to work in the evening, not for very often, unless I'm really feeling it. And sometimes I don't sleep much. I get up in the middle of the night and do it, you know. So, but I find it mostly a joy in a way. I mean, in other words, mm-hmm. I love it. And then, and obviously if you're successful, it makes everything so much easier. You know, you actually can not have to judge yourself against everybody else and start feeling the pressure of what's the next job and all those things, you know? So it's easier for me to say, you know, but that's my schedule. I mean, I've talked about this a lot also. I work on an old movie. I don't have final draft. I have an old program that requires me to have a DOS-based computer. So that's how old it is. It's called Movie Magic. Movie Master, I mean. It's it went out of business like when it couldn't figure out how to – the people who made it couldn't figure out software so you could email it. So they went out of business. But it's exactly the same functionality as Final Draft is. Mine uses function keys and they use tab keys for the exact same process. And but I like it, I mean, for a number of reasons. I'm superstitious, so I don't think I need to change. It's a pain in the ass, but it's good in some ways. It runs out of memory after 40 pages, so you have to open a new file. But that's a good way for me to think, are you done with this act yet? Because you better get it open. And so, and it's also very safe because it's not on the internet or anything. So, because I've had stuff that they've come to take out of here that they were worried with on my hard drive and all.
Right.
But, the other funny thing about it is, and I don't know why I did this, it's just because I'm such a Luddite. You should have a white piece of paper that you're typing with black type on, right? Like a typewriter you want it to look like, I guess. And I, for some reason, have a black background with white.
And I like can't DOS. Tell you what.
But I'm used to it now. So, you know, and so at some point, the thing goes over to the production company if they're going to make the movie. And they turn it into their final draft. And then I really don't even have the script anymore. Any changes I make, they have to go retype them, or I have somebody retype them into final draft, you know.
Very cool. Now, Do you, when you begin to write, do you start with character or plot when it's something original?
Even what's not original, I start with actually what I call theme.
Okay.
What is this really about? You know what I'm saying? Don't, not the story, but what's going on here? You know, what is this? And then after that, I'll lock up the story. And then I'd say character and story would be the same to me of incredible importance. And I'm very diligent with character because I think they all should sound different. Mm-hmm. I always tell a story about how I rewrote a little movie for Michael Cimino called what was it with Mickey Rourke? Of the Dragon.
Year of the Dragon, right. Year of the Dragon.
And I got to be friendly with Michael, and I saw that he had given Mickey Rourke a wallet, which had everything that was, the character would have in a wallet, like a photograph of a daughter. He supposedly had his draft card, whatever it was. And even down to like the detail of like a fortune he got from a fortune cookie, you know, that he kept like some people do. And I'll bet you that probably Mickey Rourke never looked at it, but he had it in his back pocket. He knew it was there. And that's how I look at characters, so that you have to have every understanding of the psychological portrait of the guy. What does he sound like? What is his background? I mean, you know, even down to smaller characters in the piece, so that everybody's voice is different. So character... Character, I don't know which is A, B, and C, but character, God's in the details of all the research you do, so you're using the stuff that's right. And then the most important facility to be a really great writer, and very few reach this, and I don't think I've reached it, some great novelists do, is to be able to write subtextually. And that's to be able to write not about what's going on in the scene, which most people find themselves doing because it's just... It's what we know how to do, but it's sort of Ernie the Explainer, and you're telling things that people already know, And if you can avoid that and do it metaphorically in a way, it's very hard writing, but it's what really good writing is. And there's, and when you see a good movie, normally you'll see a lot of really good metaphorical writing, or the subtextual writing. Some directors, I think Marty Scorsese is a subtextual director. He doesn't need to have you. Sometimes it's obvious what he's doing, and other times it's not. And so it's a real gift. And when the great playwrights can do it, you know, Shakespeare, I'm putting myself in company, but he didn't need to write about, you know, that on the 3 weeks from now, we're going to go do X, Y, and Z when people all know that, you know, he would have some other big concept that, and that's what theme is, right? What is the concept of this movie? I was told once by Elvis Mitchell, the ex who does an NPR show on film, and he's a really smart guy. He used to be a New York Times film critic. He thought my movies were about loneliness. And when I thought about it, I thought he might be right. Because, I mean, when I start thinking of all the films I wrote, that might be the most pervasive theme. It may be sort of underlying all sorts of things about my own life, you know. So I have that, and I also, I've never written a novel, and I keep thinking I should have, and I want to, and I think I'm a frustrated novelist, because I write very, I think, pretty good prose. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a quick, sweet story I tell. Mm-hmm. Brad Pitt was doing, we were doing a read-through of Benjamin Button, and I had what I think is pretty good prose, and Brad says, after someone read the prose, the stage directions and, you know, what people are supposedly feeling and what's going on. Brad said, look, Eric's got a prose boner.
And I can imagine him saying that.
I might have, actually.
And I can imagine him saying that. That's
this was before, you know, like 30 people in a room doing a read through with Fincher and everybody, Kate Blanchett and whoever else was there.
That's funny. Now, you adapted some amazing novels over the years. How do you approach adapting someone else's work?
Well, I mean, I think some things you have to try to be a little bit sacrosanct with, because the work is great. And if the work seems like it's not, maybe not, it's not about great or bad or good for the thing, what lends itself to be dramatized, you know? So, you know, I've done just recently this Killers of the Flower Moon, which was, you know, it's a really Herculean kind of task, but to tell this story and give it the size it deserves, plus do it with some grace and elegance, that I didn't have to really change very much. The drama's basically all there. That's more the thematic of it, about sort of that Marty and I agreed to, about this, the disappearance of sort of making the Native American invisible and that we're all culpable in a way. Mm-hmm. But also the characters were all laid out, and, you know, how do we have shadings with each of them? But I didn't have to invent particular. I mean, I had to dramatize certain things, but other books are more problematic and different. Like Dune was kind of hard.
That's almost unadaptable.
It's voluminous, you know, but you start eventually coming down to what the size of the thing hopefully should be. My scripts are usually too long, and a lot of it has to do with me, as I say, writing all this prose about what's going on. But if it's not a book that's particular, I mean, I've done a number. I consider a lot original writing. So Benjamin Button's a good case, because that was an art magazine article that F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, bless his heart, wrote. And the article really wasn't very good. He did it. It was for Collier's, and he just did it for the money. He needed the money. But he had the idea of a guy growing, you know, aging backwards.
It's a great concept.
Which is a wonderful concept. And what does that mean? And then you can get into the theme of the piece, which I think is, for me, it was like, who are the people you meet along the way of this journey? You know, either way you're going forwards or backwards. But that I started just from scratch and inventing what the story was, you know. Because the story he had was nothing that worked for me, you know what I'm saying? And it really, anybody who reads it, no matter how much you love Escachaux, will say, maybe my story's not any better, but his story was not something you write home about, really. It was just a job for him, as best I can tell. Forrest Gump, the book, was kind of farcical to me in certain respects. And So I had I made it, and it had failed a couple times. Other people had tried it and had no luck. So I had sort of free rein to do what I wanted with it. And so I just took my imagination where it went and came up with a bunch of things that he said that people seemed to latch onto, you know.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I looked at that as like doing Candide, you know, what's the journey of this guy through life. I'm trying to think what else. In the main, though, it's like being a dramatist. In other words, you have to, and I think we said this, I don't know if David said it, his father said it, or I said it, which is irrelevant on Mank, that when they're talking about, you know, about Citizen Kane, because you can't, with the line we have is to the extent of, you can't show somebody's whole life in 2 hours. All you can do is give an impression of their life.
Right.
That's, you know, another part of it. So no matter what the book was, if I adapted it, was to try to do the best to tell the best story, you know? And some are adapted. Stars Born, I think, is adapted, but we started from scratch on that one. You know, we have to go over all whatever movies. Munich was pretty close to the book. I don't think there was, except for adding some more some ingredients that weren't really dramatic per se, but were dramatic in the sense of the way Stephen can do things with trucks being stuck while little girls on the phone. And,
it's classic, know,
that kind of stuff, which is not wrong, but it's you have to come. That stuff was invented, a lot of that.
Now, you mentioned Forrest Gump because, I mean, obviously, you know, Forrest Gump, by the time you started writing Forrest Gump, you'd already been 20 years in, 20-odd years in already. So you weren't, you know, you weren't a kid anymore. So you were a very seasoned writer at this point. But I think that Forrest Gump, at least at that point in your career, was a hurricane. I mean, it is a cultural milestone. It is in the zeitgeist. I mean, people still constantly say all those lies, you know, you never know what it like, you know, all the chocolate, life's like a box of chocolate and everything, all those wonderful catchphrases. And for people who weren't around to experience it in 94, younger screenwriters, in 94, I mean, 94 was an amazing year, Pulp Fiction and Forrest. I mean, it was
Hell yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, talk apples and oranges, you know. But
right.
If you want to talk great art, I would go with Pulp Fiction. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I love Forrest Gump. Means obviously the world to me and world to a lot of people, and has sentiment and heart and, you know, goofiness. And but Pulp Fiction was a pretty lasting movie that of its kind, and ours is lasting in a different way.
Right. They're so different in so many ways. And both you and Quentin both won the Oscar that year for original and adapted, but they couldn't be more different films. And so different, but yet both of them are everlasting and completely timeless. But what was it like, even at that stage in your career, to be in the middle of that hurricane? Because, I mean, it's...
Well, you obviously can't expect it. You don't know. Right. You have no clue. I had met Tom Hanks pretty early, and we were going to do something else together. And then I was offered that book, and I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Let's go for it," you know.
And that was Tom. That was before Robert Zemeckis jumped on board, or was Robert?
Yeah. It was actually there were two or three other directors that looked like they were going to do it. One was Barry Sonnenfeld. One was Penny Marshall. Mm-hmm. And Steven was very interested in doing it at one point. But I had the advantage of knowing Tom was going to do it. He was a star, but not anywhere. He wasn't quite Tom Hanks yet.
It wasn't post Forrest Gump, Tom.
This was pre Forrest Gump. And he was actually, I think when I met him, I think he was filming.
Didn't he do Philadelphia? Wasn't he doing Philadelphia?
No, he'd done that. But when I met him, he was doing the Ron Howard movie with you know, about the mermaid.
Oh yeah! Oh God! Splash!
Splash!
Yeah, Splash! Yeah.
Oh, that was his. I think that may have been his first break from television, Bosom Buddies or something.
I think
close to it.
Close to it, but that was his big break. That was Splash. Yeah. splash, yeah. blow him up.
But as big as he was, I mean, Forrest Gump was hard to get made because I wrote a script that Warner Brothers wasn't keen on, didn't quite get it. And fortunately for us, the producer, Wendy Finerm, a very good producer, she was like 24 years old, though. she was married to Mark Canton, who ran the studio, and was able to get it in turnaround. Otherwise, I don't think they'd ever put it in turnaround. And we took it to Paramount, and Brandon Tartikoff, who was at one point the president of NBC, really nice man and really smart. He was then the head of Paramount, and he agreed to do it. I mean, to develop it. And Tom came in and pitched the whole thing. So it's easy for me having to sell it with Tom sitting there saying, because I'd say, and he's sitting on a bench, and whatever we had envisioned at that point, we hadn't written it.
Right.
And Tom acted out what we had talked about, and Brandon said, "Great, you got a deal." And you know, I did whatever work I had to do, and then we went out looking for directors, and then Zemeckis came along. You know, he read it and said, "This is for me." You know, and he was a big, obviously wonderful big director, and that was amazing. You know, so
yeah, and then it was off and running, and I mean, obviously it was just such a cultural. God, that year was such an amazing year.
No,
of course not.
No, but and also because there's a lot of fights about the money, about what we could film and not. I mean, because there's fights with the studio. I remember Bob saying, "There's a lot of blood under the bridge," he said on this movie. And he did everything known to man cleverly to get around some of the budgetary restraints. He would take a crew on Sundays, just literally four or five people, which would be Tom, cinematographer, I'm making up himself, and mm-hmm. you know, a couple of production people, and they'd fly off to go. That whole run was done on Sundays. They'd fly to Maine from, we were in South Carolina, they'd fly to Maine, shoot him running to the lighthouse, get back on the plane, and come bomb back. You know what I'm saying?
I was wondering how they did that because I mean, like,
we didn't really have the money for it, it was more about the money for it. And we thought this was pretty special, but we also thought we could just be drunk, you know.
It's tough. Thing. It's tough. Yeah, when you're in the middle
it's
of
so a... oddball this movie. I mean, in other words, it was. I've done substantial movies where you could kind of get a sense of, you know, what's solid about it, and you couldn't tell on this one. So when we got done, we started. You know, when Bob was finished, and he started previewing it, and. We had he always did previews for his movies in a very small theater at Paramount, and then a little bit larger theater somewhere, I think, in the Valley, and then a big, big theater in San Jose. And we had incredible reaction in the little theater and with whatever we got, you know, of test screening, and they were like humongous numbers. We went to the one in the Valley, I think it was, as my memory serves me well. It got incredible numbers. And everybody started getting a little nervous now. And there was really almost no criticisms of the movie, and everybody just was delighted with it, and you know, had 18 million favorite moments, all the kind of things you know about feeling good about Forrest Gump. And then we showed it up in San Jose to a huge theater that had like a balcony, and mm-hmm. I don't know, it must have held 3,000 people. Probably didn't, but I remember sitting in the balcony, and you could see down. It was one of those theaters that didn't have a middle row. So anybody getting up to go to the bathroom had to walk across like 30 people, you know, or 50 people. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we were flying home. We were on a Paramount plane, and either Sherry Lansing, or who was the president then of the studio, wonderful woman, or John Goldwyn, who was her second in command, was looking at the cards, you know, and he did percentages and all. I said, "You just went into Raiders of the Lost Ark land," because there was like 98%, 99% yes, favorable. And they knew now that we had something that was a monster, you know.
Based
and
off of that.
You still couldn't know, but they did a magnificent marketing job with that poster, you know, things like that. And then I knew I was in business when I went in the race. I was in the racetrack, like getting in line to bet. And I heard someone say, you know, do the accent. I won't, you know, he's doing Forrest Gump, right? And I said, okay.
Now, I've heard, I mean, over the years, I've talked to every screenwriting guru, so many different screenwriters. And one constant thing that it's always talked about is in order to have a story, you need conflict. That's what gets the story across. And I remember one day in film school, my screenwriting instructor said, you always need conflict except for one movie that pulled it off, and it's Forrest Gump. Forrest doesn't have any conflict. And I want to ask you the question, what – because Forrest just seems to be – the world around him is conflict. But he himself – and when you start analyzing towards the end, there is a little bit more conflict. But I just want you to kind of analyze that.
I think that's true. I mean, it's a – it is Candide. I mean, there's been a number of other things that are like Candy, where people take a journey and the conflicts within the journey. But it's also sort of the conflict, is he going to get from point A to point F? And also, I mean, the other thing I always felt there was a conflict was about the fact that he wanted this girl to love him. So you have a love story. So the love story would be the center of the piece, I guess. And then these other things he believes in, his mother and God, you know, and where is God betraying him? And, you know, I mean, it's like, I would say, a more sophisticated version. I'm not saying better or worse, but it was like being there. Mm-hmm. Right? What's the conflict in being there once he steps? What, you know, there's an initial conflict of a guy who, you know, is having, you know, certain issues, you know, sort of he has mental issues, you know, intellectual issues. And he steps into a world that he's just fine with, where, you know, he says things and everybody thinks what he's saying is, you know, the most genius thing ever said, and they all run away. But so being there was like that. No, we didn't have the normal things. You're going to get thrown out of your apartment, and that his mother, you know, was going to, you know, lock him up, or and we didn't have any of those things, you know. So that those were mostly from the book. I mean, nothing was different that way from the book. I mean, that was just his story, and I think there's, the other thing the other rule was never use voiceover. I mean, one of those guys who teach those things. Well, all the great filmmakers ever, including, if you like, Forrest Gump, uses voiceover. Marty has voiceover in every movie he's ever made.
Shawshank Redemption, not so bad.
Not so bad. Yeah, exactly. So I'm saying that I always found that funny. Who's the guy, the famous guy who wrote all the books about
writing? I think it was Robert McKee.
Robert McKee, and he said, never use voiceover.
Use voiceover in your script. It's all relative. I mean, because voiceover is a crutch sometimes.
The conflict is, I remember saying, I won't mention who it is, who was a pretty well-known actor who wrote a script and sent it to me. And I said, it's really well-written, and I think you got work to do with some of the characters and this, but you're missing the one ingredient, the big C. You have no conflict in this. So, I mean, I think you do need to know what the conflict is, how you show it, how you do it. I think there's probably varying degrees. And I probably have to, you know, probably ask somebody else who's smarter about these things than me about what would be the conflict in Forrest Gump. I don't know.
Well, good. Now,
maybe it's him versus the universe in a way. The irony is the universe.
Yeah. I would agree. I would agree with you.
In other words, look at, I mean, all these ridiculous things, you know, which we always were taken by, you know, how ironic or sort of ludicrous the absurdity of Ronald Reagan getting shot, or, you know, Bobby Kennedy. I mean, all these things, all the assassinations and, you know, these wars we entered into. And I mean, in other words, it's all slightly insane, you know.
Well, the whole story is slightly insane in many ways.
It is.
But one of my favorite lines in the entire movie, and it's not one of the famous lines, is when he opened up the letter and he goes, I invested in a fruit company.
That's right. I know.
And I didn't need to worry about money anymore. One less thing.
That's right. Yeah, well, I don't know why it came to me. I said it'd be kind of funny if he owned Apple, you know.
Because we all say that.
They actually say if he, you know, he would have to kept the stock, but that by whatever the price was then, they figured out that next to, like, Tim Cook, he would have to be the second largest stockholder of Apple if he didn't sell it, you know, if he just kept it.
Yeah, him and Jobs were like, they were neck and neck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because everyone always jokes like, I should have bought Tesla. I should have bought Apple at $8, you know.
Well, I had the same thing with when we did House of Cards for Netflix. Mm-hmm. Not one of my genius financial people.
Bought Netflix?
No, she said buy Netflix stock. It was at like eight. I didn't buy a nickel. I mean, I would have done. I'm not. I don't invest much in anything, but I would have probably. I don't know.
I'll throw a couple bucks. Couple bucks in there.
Exactly. Now whatever it is, 900 now or something.
Something, you know? Ridiculous like that. Now you have. I mean, you have collaborated with some of the most amazing filmmakers in history. We were just talking about Kurosawa, obviously Fincher, Spielberg, Michael Mann. Like, how do you collaborate with such established and then sometimes even legendary, like a Kurosawa or a Spielberg?
Well, Kurosawa was less of a collaboration in the sense that he trusted me to write this character. And if he, whatever he didn't like, he told me, just could we not have him say this? Or would
Sure.
That was a little easier. It's very long distance, you know. Sure.
But Michael Mann or Spielberg.
Each was different because some of them were writer directors.
Right.
So Michael Mann was a writer also. So we had a shorthand together, and he's a tough guy, and we fought like cats and dogs about stuff. But I can hold my own, and I also believe, to just be honest, that it's not capitulating. But I think you'll find. Let's say you have my way and you'll have Fincher's way. And it doesn't have to be the highway then, you know what I'm saying? There might be a third path that makes you feel you've created what you felt was accurate and right for the material. And so does David. David's a little tougher. David's very logical about what he wants and nothing wrong with it. Whatever one line is said, that whatever comes back has some logic to it. It's a response. I'm a little more fanciful in the stuff I've done, so I never looked at things that way. Michael Mann is a wonderful writer and very analytical. Mm-hmm. And he came up with a great thing for The Insider, which it turned out to be, I think, needed. And I would have never thought of it. There's a scene early on, and we were talking earlier about, you know, trying to write subtextually as opposed to expositionally, which is just bad writing mostly. But Michael felt we needed to lay out for the audience quite early what were the impediments to this guy and what needed to be accomplished. So we have a scene set in what's supposed to be the CBS kind of kitchen where they're having like a lunch. And it's all exposition, which is not something I'm wild about. But he said, we need to get this guy a lawyer. We need to get this guy that. We need to go talk to this guy. We need to get him out of his contract. You know, in other words, and those were the kind of, Michael's analytic about, these were the kind of points we had to, the dramatic points we were going to have to overcome to become, where the dramatics worked for the movie succeeding. And it's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had so many people on the show that has worked with Steven. And I've just found so amazing how many careers he's touched in early on, you know, Kevin Reynolds and John Lee Hancock. And like, he's the one that opened doors for people.
Yeah, he did.
I
never had that relationship with him. I actually knew him when he was very young. He roomed with somebody I wrote a TV movie for.
Okay.
He was probably 18. And he was, even then, a wonderful entertainer, wonderful, you know, dramatic director. He has his own way of working. I mean, he's quite different than a lot of the people we're talking about. And he wants things in certain ways. He had one thing I liked about working with him was that Kathy Kennedy, who I adore, is his producer. And I would send the pages to Steven, and Kathy would then call me and say, this is what he likes and what he doesn't like. And I like that. So when you went in and I went to meet with him about the work, you don't get your back up right away. You know, you get in a beef or you get insulted or your feelings hurt or whatever it is, you know, about the work. You already know what's, and you've thought about it. Why is this not working? Why is it? How can we make this work for him and all of that? So, yeah, he was an interesting guy to work with. And it didn't come out. I mean, it wasn't wholly. He felt at some point that he wanted to have a little bit of a different voice, and he brought in Tony Kushner, who I adore and is a friend, who was one of the great writers in theater of Angels in America. Mm-hmm. And he wanted something a little more intellectual than some of the things I was writing. So, I was wounded by it to some extent, but it all worked out in the end that we ended up having a movie that we're all very proud of, you know?
So, yeah, and now you're working with Marty on...
Marty and I were supposed to work on two or three other things, and this was like Marty's a dream. I mean, it's like, to me, Fincher and him are very different in their approach, but each are so, and Steven is too, but I mean, it's just these two guys I know better. I've done two things with Dave, and I've known Marty over the years, and Marty completely says, feels like you're a thoroughbred and you should have your head and just try to invent and imagine anything you want, and he'll figure out a way to try to do it. And if he doesn't think it works, he tells you in the nicest way. So let's try it this way, you know, and he'll take you off whatever you might get stuck on, you know.
Yeah, and he has that art. He has the ability to almost the political aspect of being a filmmaker. It's like, as opposed to some other directors who are a little bit more hard-handed about it.
Yeah.
Marty's softer, and he just knows how to play the game so well that by the time you're over here, you're like, how did I get over here? I'm like, Marty's like, that's because I'm Marty.
I mean, it's also, you also know he, at least going in, that he probably will get the money to be able to do anything he wants. It'll have the backing of things, which is a big difference, you know, where somebody says, like, we can't do that because it's too expensive or something. And he'll say to you, try it. You know, let's see what it looks like. If you want to, if you decide you want to run, do the whole movie backwards or people walking backwards, he'll try it. You know what I'm saying? It might not work, but he'll try it.
And it's amazing how now Marty is working with Netflix, because Netflix is basically, I mean, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I wouldn't say they're giving him a blank check, but they're giving him a lot of leeway. Well,
he's actually moved on for the moment. He'll go back to Netflix, but I think this is Apple.
Sorry.
Apple's paying for this.
Apple's paying for this.
Apple credit, Apple really.
But he's going to the streamers, though. He's going to streamers now.
I mean, that's where you're going to get the money from. But he does. I know that he wanted this on this, that he wanted a certain amount of a theatrical release that's not just a few days or a week. So he's going to get that with Paramount's going to release it theatrically. Then Apple will have it part of the service and streaming service. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing for both. For Apple, I think the idea of having Marty and Leonardo DiCaprio and Bob De Niro on this kind of big subject matter that will be wonderful for subscriptions and all that. And I think it's great when it works out that way. I mean, David has a blank check to a certain extent. I mean, I can't speak to that, but in other words, anything creatively he wants to do, Netflix is his home, and they embrace David the way they should. So they're giving, in a way, an artist a chance to always express himself. How great is that? You know, I think he's earned it. So
without question. So you were there at the beginning with House of Cards, which it is one of those moments in time where the business changed. The entire industry changed from the moment that Netflix says we're going to do original programming, and we're going to spend obscene amounts of money on an original IP. We have great people working on it, but it was when that came out, people were like, wait, what? That was it.
Well, the story goes, which is true. I was sent, and so was David. Ari Emanuel was, I think, trying to sign David more than me, but he wanted me as a client also at the time. And I said, you know, this is silly, Ari. I'm a little old for it. I've been the same agent for 32 years, which he knew. And, he said, what if I sent you a really great piece of material? I said, I'm always up for material. So he sent me House of Cards on video, you know, which was the English show. Mm-hmm. And I said, I said to him, this is spectacular. I happen to know it because Michael Mann and Al Pacino had thought about doing it as a movie because it's just Richard III. You know, that's what it is.
Right.
So for whatever reason, we never worked it out doing it, but it would have been great. So I said to David, if this is something you want to do, I mean, I think there's a way to do this and not very difficult. Obviously the work will be difficult, but that this would translate beautifully into about America's politics. Mm-hmm. And so we hired a writer, Bo Willimon, who had written a play about, I forget the title of, but it was a movie that actually George Clooney made, which understood politics quite well. And Dave was agreed to direct the first couple or three, and we got them, at that point, Kevin Spacey was a great find, and David had worked with him, and I helped get Robin Wright, because she had been in Forrest Gump and all, and we were friends. And mm-hmm. So we've had a great package, I think, and there was an auction then, and all the players were there at that point. They came to David's office, HBO, and I guess Showtime, whoever it was, you know, whoever was in business then, and Netflix. And Netflix made an incredible offer. And I got to be honest, I understood that I thought there would be a place for this in time. But I said to David, I don't think there's enough eyeballs yet for this. And I think I would like to have the water cooler conversation like on The Sopranos they had, you know, at HBO, you know, mm-hmm. and I thought they were, the class of the field. And he said, you're wrong. He said, there's people going to. No, he did. And he mm-hmm. said, you're a Luddite. You don't know what you're talking about. And this is going to be, you know, people are going to watch this if we can make it, you know, attractive enough and interesting enough and dramatic and all that. And we were the first show was a show that Stevie Van Zandt did or something about called Oslo or something, mm-hmm. a small little thing in Norway. And then it was us. And obviously, you know what happened. That people started binging it and going crazy. And all of a sudden, they got a giant amount of subscriptions, which gave them money to go do other shows. And, you know, it's a mixed blessing to me because I'm such a movie lover and love going to the movies and a 40-foot screen and everything. But I watch things on my phone like anybody else, you know, and some things translate, some things don't. I like that it's available to everybody. I mean, one of the things I learned early on was, it wasn't that early, but we had like a 20th reunion of Forrest Gump at USC, and mm-hmm. everybody was Bob and, you know, Gary Sinise, the Hulk, everybody. And Bob asked the audience, how many people, we showed the film first on a, you know, in a screening there. And Bob said, how many people is this the first time ever seeing it on a movie, on a screen? Everybody.
Of course, they're children. They're all children.
Yeah, that's right. They're all watching on TV.
Of course.
So, you know, it's like, all right. I understand when there's so many more people watching something, how beneficial that is, you know?
Well, I mean, it started with cable and VHS. I mean, that's where movies – Yeah, I mean, Terminator was made on cable, you know, and that's where it became.
Yeah. So I was behind the curve on that one, and but you know, now I don't know if we've reaped the wind, you'll sow the whirlwind, or if this is. I think it's a mixed blessing. I mean, in the main, it's probably good. I mean, it was a little disillusioning to me that they and particularly the way they handled it about Dune going right to, you know, day and date with being on the streaming service the same time it was being released. But I think mm-hmm. they're going to rectify some of that.
I just read the article this morning that it's going to be a 45-day window. So they are going to do a 45-day window on Dune. I just literally read it this morning on
Trades. Well, I'll have to call my agent when we hang up, see if I can get some money out of it.
Yeah, so it is going to be, from what I read on the trades, yeah. Dune is going to be released 45 days, and then it'll end up on Max.
It deserves to be seen. I've seen it. It deserves to be seen on a great big screen and have the sound and sight, and it's pretty amazing.
But to be honest, like, how do you approach that subject matter? It's just such
It was pretty daunting. But I mean, honestly, I'm a old hippie. I've done my fair share of, I'm not advocating anybody do this, my fair share of hallucinogenics. And I thought that even though I had some issues with the book, but the book is transcended in some respects. And certainly for when I read it with a 15-year-old boy. And I felt there's a spirit to it that I could probably capture and take you to places you haven't really thought about or seen. And I wrote a big, full, fat draft, and it needed cutting down, and Denis Villeneuve did that wonderfully. And then I think they brought in another writer, because I've moved on by then, to kind of even more grounded. A guy named John Spates is really terrific. Mm-hmm. And so the three of us, I think, ended up creating something pretty amazing. And then Denis, obviously, I think, realized, and for what I saw, you know, as a piece, a real work of art, and really a wonderful adventure and everything else. It's pretty special. I mean, I would tell you if it wasn't.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that you would.
I'm very honest if I don't think things work. Yeah.
Now, also, when you were going to tackle Star is Born, I mean, that movie has been remade, what, three times before you? Yeah, this was the fourth. And every time it was a hit, from what I understand. Yeah. And it was always like this kind of cultural touchstone when it came out.
Yeah.
And then you've got Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, and Bradley's the director. As well. First time director. So you've got this. How do you approach telling that story again?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. That was kind of a challenge. Not the work was very really challenging, but I don't know. I hadn't had a movie made, and I was so used to getting movies made like every 2-3 years, and I hadn't had a movie made. Maybe it's 3 years, maybe a little more. And that movie, even though it was nominated for an Oscar, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Slow, was not that well received either critically or box office, and it was a disappointment to me. And there are many reasons why I think I F some things up, and I think that there were some decisions that maybe should have been made differently. But you know, that's what happened. And they offered me the Star Is Born. And I said, "Is this a good idea for me to one? Am I too old for this? I mean, not just to understand the culture and music, and you know, and be as contemporary as it should be." And and they sent me a script which I thought needed work. And I said, I kind of feel like I've got to, you know, start from scratch to some extent. There were some things there that were certainly good. And I said, they said, you got to do it quickly. And I said, in 6 weeks, I'll have for you something new. And I think hopefully you'll like it. And I went to work, and Bradley was there every day. I mean, we would text each other in the middle of the night. And he was wonderful to work with and had his own ideas about things. And we'd fight like cats and dogs, which I do with everybody. And in the end, we had something, I think, which had the humanity that I think I can bring to things, and he understood. And I think it was a great contemporary story. One of the really wonderful moments for me in that one was Bradley and I and Lady Gaga were working at her house out in Malibu. And it was the first time I'd met her, actually. And Bradley had to go, and I was going to leave when he did. And she said, "Do I mind staying?" I said, "No." She said, "I'd love to talk about the character." And we did that. And I said, "Take a look at Moonstruck, how Cher played in Moonstruck, you know, certain things." I said, I'll do everything I can to make this easy for you, because she wasn't, she's acted, but she wasn't her, you know, profession necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so I promised her I'd make things as conversational as possible in the script, that there didn't have to be big monologues and all that. And then I was getting to leave. She said, "Do you mind if I play something for you?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay." So she sat down at the piano and she played Somewhere Over the Rainbow and sang it. It was like, "Are you kidding me?" It's like, "Oh my God, God just walked in." You know, really, it was like, get the hell. I mean, maybe it was not so accidental, but it was like unbelievable. I mean, it was like one of those moments you just never forget.
You know? So a private concert by Lady Gaga at her house in Malibu.
I just played some of the songs they were thinking about. And when I went and watched it with an audience, I was just so thrilled that people just really loved it, and they laughed and they cried, and you know, the kind of thing that a good love story does. And you know, and I think Bradley, you know, added immensely to it. He had some great ideas for storytelling, and he certainly made it feel real. And I think we did well together, you know.
Now, what are 3 screenplays you think every screenwriter should read?
Well, I guess you'd have to start. I don't know, but that's one of those, you know, what's the best movie ever made? You know, it's probably 20, you know?
Sure. But 3 that come to mind.
Wow, this is so hard. I mean, I guess you'd have to say Citizen Kane, because it has multiple points of view of one person. It's probably the first time that was ever done. And that's just fresh with me because I'm Mank. Mm-hmm. I would say Chinatown. Yeah. Because that's a movie that is all subtextual. Mm-hmm. You're saying 3. This is so impossible. I'll give you another. I mean, to me, my favorite movie ever is 2000, either Godfather or 2001. So I don't know how to differentiate between sort of perfection.
They're fairly different.
Yeah, but so different. But Godfather 2 is perfect.
Probably. I always come – anytime anyone says Godfather, I'm like, I will grant you Godfather 1 and 2 as a oneer, because it's just – as a whole, that's perfection.
It to me is you know, even more perfect. And 2001 changed my life in some way, you know, so as a movie experience, you know. So
absolutely.
I mean, there's so many. I mean,
there's hundreds. 3 that just kind of like to start guiding people. Chinatown always shows up. Godfather always shows up. 2001 doesn't show up as much because it's
Well, it's not a script, you would say, but look at the sparseness of it. And then,
oh no,
you know,
the movie, it's
and the use of the, I know, but those things have to still be written. He had to write down that there's something that's a black monolith, even though it's from a book, I know, but
sure.
The whole idea of that. So it's the use of ideas. Yeah, I don't know. It's like, you know, where do things leave off between what the writing is? And that's where you get into a whole thing. I mean, one of the famous, I'll give you a funny little thing about Citizen Kane, which is used as a thing about Writers Guild and the whole credit dispute when you have a credit. So they say, what if I gave you a script which was about a famous magnate who owned newspapers and actually helped start a war and was one of the richest men in the world, and he lived all alone, you know, sort of cloistered with his girlfriend up in this place, Xanadu, basically, and... and, you know, it attracts his life, you know, from beginning to end. And you say, it sounds like a pretty great story. You know, it'd be great. So you'd get credit for that, right? Eric Roth. And then someone comes along, they read it, they send it to another writer, says, is there anything you'd add to it? And the writer writes on page one, Rosebud, on the last page, Rosebud. And I said, they get credit too. You know what I'm saying? that design. So, you know, I don't know. Screenplays are a tricky thing. I mean, I think they're a great craft. I'm not sure they're a great art form. You can be artful at it, but they're a craft. Because you can get away without finishing sentences. There's dots and dashes. You're not a playwright. You're not a novelist. It's a bastardized form of writing of a way. And it's also something that you need to, it doesn't really exist unless you get it made as a movie, you know? I mean, it could be something to read. It might be interesting. And there are many scripts that probably hold their own. There's a famous one called Harrow Alley that everybody always loved about the plague that a guy named Walter Newman wrote. He also wrote Cat Blue and a bunch of movies. And but that always holds up, I guess, as a great piece of, you know, it could have been a short story or something. But it's of no value, whatever scripts I don't have made, you know, that sit on the floor here. Yeah,
Best-selling screenplays like you could sell.
You wouldn't even feel they were if you bought them and read them. They might be really interesting visually and interesting, but they're such, as I say, bastardized form of things. Other people would add probably in American screenplays, probably add Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid because it created a whole way of looking at, you know, is so meta in its way, you know, it was very postmodern. I could give you all the screenplays that matter, you know?
Right. Of course. But I always tell people that screenwriting is arguably one of the most difficult forms of writing because of the condensed amount and like the you can't go like a novelist and just write.
Good writers do less is more. I unfortunately haven't quite got there. I mean it. I really do. I mean,
but you've done okay, Eric. You've done okay.
No, but the director, I've done okay. But the directors appreciate the fact there's a lot more because they can make choices
and they sometimes can cut down.
They can cut down.
It's better to have too much and cut down.
Job. Which is their job. I mean, I think good director is a great editor.
Absolutely.
Take your work, recraft it, refashion it. I mean, I always say that it's like kind of building a book. That's what the writer gets to do, and then director gets to take it on his journey, you know.
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
I would first of all ask them to please watch every movie they could watch and also read every book they can read so they have knowledge of both forms. I think literature is as important as film literature. Get to know what characterizations are, get to know what dramatizing something is, even in comedy. In other words, everything's going to come back to three acts, maybe four. I don't care if you stand on your head, if you do Pulp Fiction, which starts to end and ends up in the beginning. It makes no difference. You're still going to have a beginning. You're going to start complicating the problem in the second act. And the third act, you're going to come to either a conclusion by God coming in and a machine, Deus Ex Machina, or you find a catharsis for people that they find organically amongst themselves, and the movie's going to end with some conclusion or left inconclusive. So these rules will always apply. I think I'd have everybody try to read and get a sense of what drama is, how to describe, do this, and then also to I don't know, some people, and it's like anybody, anything else, some people are just better than you at things. So just write to your own levels. I mean that. In other words,
yeah, absolutely.
See, everybody tries to, you know, say, I want to be Aaron Sorkin, or I want to be, and you're not going to be Aaron Sorkin. You're going to be whoever you are. And maybe you'll end up being, you know, more valuable than Aaron Sorkin in some way, but you also may also write for the great comedies or for the most popular movies. And there's no criteria for any of this. I think people, if you can't write it, I think put it right into it. Just talk into a tape recorder. I tell people that all the time. We say, I want you to do my life story. And I said, you do your life story, you know, and talk into a tape recorder, have it transcribed. And all of a sudden you'll have yourself basically a basis for a screenplay, you know, and everybody has something interesting to say about themselves and about their lives. So I think it's true when they say write about what you know, but I would say don't write necessarily what you know. I think write about what you know, but not specifically necessarily. It'll come in any – you can't stop from whatever you know coming into a screenplay.
And what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I would say in life that I don't need to always be validated. I mean, it's like it's a whole world of that, wanting these trophies and wanting people, you maybe don't need critics or whatever you think, you know, it starts telling you who you are, that you can be yourself without that. And I still haven't really quite learned it. I mean, I still have anxiety about things, you know, I don't know. Part of it is who I am, about needing somebody's love, who I may not have gotten the way I wanted it, all that thing. What was the question?
Either the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life.
I still think I'm learning this subtextual thing about the and you'll find that great books have it. I mean, in other words, you get it right. You know, it's not something you can quite. I just don't think I get up to the line, and in many cases I can do it, and I can't quite always do it. I think I probably took too much time to write things before. I'm a little quicker now. I was a little too precious with stuff, maybe, you know. I always wanted it to be the best version of what this was when I turned it in, even though the next day you start looking at it and go, oh my God, you know, this ain't so good. But the other thing is, if you can look at it, look, it's very simple for me to say, I get paid a lot of money. I get to live a great life. I get to meet with all sorts of interesting people, not only actors and directors, but get to do research on things that are worlds I don't know anything about. Get to be a journalist of a kind. And it's a struggle for, like, I have people in my family who are struggling who want to be writers, you know, and it's like, and they just got to keep knocking their heads against it if that's what they want to be, you know. And I know people who've had one movie made in 40 years and they're still writing, you know, and yet, that getting up and saying there's that blank page can be either incredibly frightening or incredibly liberating. And I think there's somewhere in between. And I don't think it has to do necessarily with being rewarded, but at least that you can finish it and then see if you can get a reward out of it. You know? Me to say, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, but look, a lot of these core things that you're talking about, no matter if you've won an Oscar or you've just written your first screenplay, apply.
Yeah, I can tell you this, that after I won the Oscar for Forrest Gump, I was up for a job called The Horse Whisperer.
Yeah.
That Bob Redford directed. And I remember he didn't say it this way, but we met the first time and he basically said, what have you done for me lately? So I knew, okay, you're going to have to start all over. You know what I'm saying? You have to prove yourself all over again. And every time I go up to the bat, you know, it's a little less daunting now because you have, I don't feel the same quite pressure, but but you still want to get these things made. And it's like, then you have to go. I have three things I'm basically working on and starting. And I have the same excitement and a little bit of anxiety about, will I be able to make this different? What is it going to make this stand out? What are these voices going to be that are unique? But it's like I said, I'm lucky to be able to do it.
Eric, it has been an absolute pleasure honor to speak to you. It has been great, and I hope our conversation helps a few screenwriters out there. So thank you so much, my friend.
Just do it, you know?
I really want to thank Eric for taking the time and coming on the show to drop his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Eric, thank you very much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/122. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. And as always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.